Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 4, 2005. From New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez. The scope of the refugee crisis from the tsunami escalates. We get reports from Aceh and India's affected city of Madras. New calls for a recount in the state of New Mexico. And Senegal's government has signed a peace deal with the movement of democratic forces of the Casamance, possibly ending one of West Africa's longest-running wars. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The 109th U.S. Congress opened today by swearing in its newest members. The Senate also sent a message of sympathy to the people of Asia who have suffered such devastating losses after an earthquake and subsequent tsunami took the lives of more than 120,000 people. Secretary of State Colin Powell is now traveling in the region. However, since Powell is leaving the post, President Bush has assigned his brother, Florida Governor Jeb Bush, to spearhead U.S. relief efforts in Asia. We'll have more on living with the devastation from the tsunami coming up. Former U.S. military leaders are asking the Bush administration to reconsider the nomination of Alberto Gonzalez as Attorney General over letters Gonzalez wrote that approve the use of torture. Adam Sharon reports from D.C.
12 retired military leaders released a letter today calling on the Senate to scrutinize Alberto Gonzalez's nomination to be the next Attorney General. The admirals and generals, including former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, John Shalakashvili, questioned Gonzalez's role in formulating United States policy on torture in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Guantanamo Bay. The letter charges that interrogation operations have undermined intelligence gathering efforts, fostered international animosity toward the United States, and added to the risks facing American troops serving around the world. The letter also expresses concern about Gonzalez's recommendation that the Geneva Conventions do not apply to the conflict in Afghanistan. The 12 generals and admirals urged senators to ask the current White House counsel if he plans to revise course as Attorney General and recommit the United States to the Geneva Conventions. Mr. Gonzalez's confirmation hearings begin on Thursday. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Adam Sharon.
Chile's former dictator Augusto Pinochet will face charges on human rights violations now that the Supreme Court tossed a defense appeal to dismiss the charges. Jorge Garatón has more from Santiago.
Chile's former dictator Augusto Pinochet will stand trial in the forced kidnapping of 9 people and the murder of another after the Supreme Court quashed a defense appeal. This landmark ruling by the Supreme Court paves the way for Pinochet to face charges on human rights violations for the first time. The court ruled Pinochet can face the charges in the so-called Operation Condor, a 1970s alliance of 6 South American dictatorships to persecute and kill perceived opponents to the military regimes. The defense argued that Pinochet's failing health and diminishing mental state prevented the 89-year-old former dictator from defending himself against the charges. For FSRN News, this is Jorge Garretón in Santiago.
The governor of the Baghdad province was killed today in just one of a series of attacks against the U.S.-installed interim government. Dave Enders reports from Baghdad.
Gunmen ambushed Ali al-Hadari as he drove to work this morning from his home in the northern neighborhood of the capital. Hadari survived at least 2 prior assassination attempts, and his deputy governor was killed by gunmen, also while on his way to work, in November. Hadari made some waves in the fall when he demanded that the U.S. military evacuate the Green Zone, which serves as the occupation headquarters and houses the U.S. Embassy in central Baghdad. There were similar attacks over the weekend, and the continuing violence has prompted some Iraqi officials, including U.S.-appointed President Razi al-Yawar, to again raise the question of postponing countrywide elections scheduled for January 30th. However, no one in the U.S.-appointed interim government has called for delays outright. I'm David Enders, reporting from Baghdad for Free Speech Radio News.
At least 7 Palestinians were killed this morning during an Israeli military invasion in the Gaza Strip. According to doctors in a local hospital, all of them were under 18. From Occupied Gaza, Mohammed Omar has more.
In this morning's attack, the victims were mainly high school students on their way to school to take their final exam. Four of those killed were brothers. Doctors say the number of casualties is likely to increase from those who have lost body parts or are critically injured. The Israeli military claimed the attack was in response to mortar fired by Hamas at the Israeli settlement, but there has been no confirmation of such attack by any Palestinian group. The Egyptian foreign minister called the ongoing Israeli attack in Gaza a provocation meant to hinder the Sunday's Palestinian presidential elections and called for a withdrawal of Israeli troops from the area. For Free Speech Radio News, Mohammed Omar, Gaza Strip.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
The tsunami death toll in Aceh today rose to 90,000, and over 1 million people are internally displaced. Refugees are everywhere across Aceh, and even though the humanitarian aid is now flowing into Indonesia, volunteers are facing difficulties in distributing the aid. From Banda Aceh, Megi Mariono has the story.
This is one among hundreds of refugee camps in Aceh. Every day and night, the non-search read off the list of missing persons in case they are in this camp. The residents in this camp still lack of clean water, food and sanitation. To get food, around 3,000 people from this camp have to wait in line. A tent coordinator has to hold a food voucher to get a pack of instant noodles and a pack of bottled water for a tent that contains 8 families. If they do not have a carpen, they will never get any food. Hadija is one of the people in Hui, but she received no food pack.
Nasi belum dapat sampai hari ini.
I didn't get any food, since I am here just with my daughter and we are not a member of any group. My group is not in this camp, but I came here because I just found out that my daughter is alive and staying here.
Camp managers don't know when or if any rice will arrive. Yahri is the coordinator of food distribution in this camp. He says that this camp is not well stocked.
There is no more rice and cooking oil in stock. We have only biscuits, water, and second-hand clothes. We only received 1 ton of rice, and after that, no more rice comes here.
Since tsunami hit Aceh, there has been no place to buy food, causing a food crisis. Since the shops were destroyed, petty traders have been selling food at a 200% markup. While today a small number of shops has opened, but they are safely understocked and don't allow buyers to enter the stores for fear of looters. They require people to wait outside. People who have not lost their homes also try to get food packs at the food distribution centers and cause even greater hardship in these camps. Suyati is a camp member.
They are not a member of this camp who are supposed to receive food, and then they sell the food to us. They are laughing while bringing food packs.
Even some trucks that bring food to the camps were held up by robbers whose identities could not be confirmed. Yesterday, 3 robbers were shot by the Indonesian army when they tried to rob an aid truck. The Indonesian army claimed the robbers were members of Free Aceh Movement, but yet there is no confirmation about the claim. From disaster site in Aceh, Megi Margiono reporting for Free Speak Radio News.
The tsunami has also virtually disappeared India's Andaman and Nicobar archipelago islands, while rescue efforts in the southern city of Madras are slow. But as our correspondent Binu Alex reports, while the aid is flowing into the affected areas, experts say survivors will suffer the trauma of the tsunami for a long time to come.
Television camera crews are gradually shifting from a tsunami-dominated week to their regular routine programming. But for the survivors who have relatives on the missing list, the nightmare continues. Official numbers out of India state that about 9,500 have died and more than 5,000 are missing. This toll could increase, and so would the trauma among the survivors, as the maximum impact of the killer waves were on women and children. Experts in trauma counseling are addressing this problem in the disaster-struck areas. As relief efforts and trauma counseling continue, Indian leaders are looking at how to better prepare for natural disasters. At the Indian Science Congress meeting in Ahmedabad yesterday, the Indian Prime Minister Dr. Manmohan Singh asked the scientists how best technology can be used for humanity.
Science and technology must play a greater role in our strategy to address the problems of prevention, mitigation, and management of the impact of natural disorders.
And scientists are examining the possibility to see whether methods used by primitive tribes of Andaman and Nicobar can be used to predict earth tremors in the future. These tribes, believed to have been vanished initially from the terrains inaccessible by the outsiders, have apparently survived the tsunami. They are said to have run to higher ground for safety after noticing changes in the behavior of birds and marine wildlife. The government has barred aid from reaching these areas, citing security reasons, being a military base, and is instead ferrying the survivors to Port Blair, the capital of the federally administered islands. But the aid agencies are facing logistical nightmares, reaching some of the worst affected Andaman and Nicobar Islands, close to the epicenter of the earthquake. The Information and Broadcasting Secretary, Naveen Chawla, however, said everything is being done to ensure that aid reaches all.
The emphasis is first, of course, on drinking water, on cooked food, on medicine, on torches, on candles, on matchsticks that can be provided to them.
There have been complaints of uneven distribution of relief materials. Some villagers received more food than they could eat, while others had none. In an effort to return to normalcy, many survivors, mostly fishermen, have left the relief camps to salvage the remains and start their new lives. From Ahmedabad in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
Senegal's government has signed a peace deal with the Movement of Democratic Forces of the Casamance, or the MFDC, ending one of West Africa's longest-running wars. Thousands of people cheered as the interior minister and rebel leader put their names to a ceasefire pact. However, many more fear that this will just be another one of the many agreements that have been signed over the years, with no particular action taken by either party. But this agreement does bring some hope for peace in the Casamance, the region known as the breadbasket of Senegal. From Senegal, FSRN's Njaga Sek reports.
Last Thursday, the Senegalese government and Movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance, or MFDC, signed a peace agreement to end 22 years of armed war. The signature ceremony was held in front of the governors of Ziguinchor. In an official visit to the presidential palace in Dakar, the Bishop Jamakun Senghor, president of MFDC, suggested that the peace accord be signed where war broke out one morning in December, 22 years ago.
We gather here today to sign a peace accord. May it be followed by decisions and actions that contribute to the return of peace in Casamance. The economic and social development of Casamance has to come with peace, a peace that's not built on moving grounds of unrealism and arbitration.
Casamance is the breadbasket of Senegal. It is a tropical area full of natural resources, but Casamance lacks roads, electricity, and running water. Lack of government attention to these problems finally triggered an armed rebel war in 1982. Fighting between the Senegalese military and rebel armed groups claimed the southerns, and refugees fled to neighboring Gambia and Guinea-Bissau as orchards and rice paddies became minefields. Today, Casamance is in full reconstruction as the Senegalese government has vowed to invest $160 million in the region. Schools, health centers, roads, and dams are finally being constructed, and the Senegalese President Abdoulaye Wade says 2 decades of war have been too long.
To our victims widowed or orphaned, injured by bullets or landmines, and to the whole nation, I express my compassion. The Casamance conflict will have been a very sad episode in our history, as circumstances placed brothers and sisters at both sides of the front line.
d'un côté et de l'autre d'une ligne d'affrontement.
Numerous accords have been signed in the past with no respect from both parties. Today, the average Casamas inhabitant is in favor of durable peace. War in Casamas created an acute economic crisis and the sinking of Lojola, the ferry boat that linked the region to Senegal's capital Dakar in 2002, plunged the economy into total despair. Now, the main concern of many is to relaunch the economy. Seydou Diatta is from Tendouk, northern Casamas.
Nous voulons que la Casamance ait la paix.
We want peace in Casamance. Without peace, there's no development. We also want the Senegalese government to turn to Casamance and start building it. We also want forgiveness between ourselves, without exception. Casamance must be developed as all the other Senegalese regions.
Le pardon, c'est une région du Sénégal.
The Casamance crisis is the oldest armed conflict in West Africa. It has never gained enough media support due to lack of economic concern from developed countries. The agreement signature is only one step, since the road to forgiveness, reconciliation and durable peace in Casamance will be a long one. For FSIN in Senegal, I'm Jaga Sek.
Brother Cornel West, I'm just hoping and praying that you have the good enough sense to always tune in to Free Speech Radio News. Lays bare the truth and inspires you to fight for justice. Free Speech Radio News.
Today, David Cobb, Green Party U.S. presidential candidate, and his legal team called for a recount in New Mexico. This comes as New Mexico's Secretary of State's office recently released a report finding numerous errors and discrepancies with the counting and reporting of New Mexico's presidential vote. This is only one in a series of actions taking place across the U.S. that may threaten the swearing-in of George W. Bush for his second term as president, as Ingrid Drake of the D.C. Radio Co-op reports.
Today, as new members of Congress held parties celebrating the day of their official swearing-in, Reverend Jesse Jackson of the Rainbow Push Coalition visited Senate Democrats to ask for a more thorough investigation of several states with voting irregularities, but especially Ohio. Jackson is calling for senators to challenge Ohio's Electoral College votes on Thursday, when Congress meets in a joint session to certify each state's electoral votes.
There was substantial fraud in Ohio, more so than in Florida. It deserves a thorough investigation. Exit polling was accurate in 47 states, but not in Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Florida, the target states.
Michigan Democratic Congressman John Conyers has led an effort in the House to object to the seating of Ohio delegates on Thursday and is seeking a senator to join him. One senator and one representative is needed to challenge the electoral votes from a state and would force both chambers of Congress to go into a four-hour debate before certifying the Electoral College votes. Illinois Senator Dick Durbin, the newly elected Democratic whip, will not join Congressman Conyers' call for challenging the certification.
There have been a lot of investigations, and the final certified vote in Ohio had the president winning by over 100,000 votes. So it doesn't appear that whatever occurred, it reaches a level where you can say that Ohio did not have the result that most people announced. I think at this point, as unhappy as I am, it's a reality.
And looking back at 2000, do you think you would have made the decision to be a Senate sponsor?
Well, you know, Al Gore at that point said no, don't go forward with the challenge. He felt it should end. The Supreme Court had ruled. The Republican Congress was not likely to overturn it, nor is it likely to overturn this election. So at some point you have to say the people have spoken. As unhappy as we are with their decision, we have to move forward.
Reverend Jesse Jackson disagrees and says there is ample evidence to suggest a more thorough investigation into the 2004 election.
In urban Akron, Youngstown, Cleveland, Cincinnati, people, mostly black, stood in lines 4 to 6 hours to vote. The suburbs, 30 minutes, while there were dry machines inside the warehouses.
Without a strong message from the Democratic leadership in the Senate, it will be a large political risk for any senator to join Conyers in his challenge. Rumors are circulating that California Senator Barbara Boxer is considering an objection, and there are also hopes the recently elected Democratic Senator Barack Obama from Illinois, the only African American in the U.S. Senate, will lend his support. Democratic Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts says he has not yet made his decision.
Well, I think this is still very much up in the air.
present time.
Congressman Conyers' office has yet to hear from a senator willing to join his challenge. Some senators may not have received a visit from Reverend Jackson yet, such as Senator Hillary Clinton from New York. What do you think of Conyers' efforts to seek a Senate sponsor on an electoral challenge?
I don't know anything about it, but I have a high regard for Congressman Conyers, and I really appreciate the way he has kept the issue of electoral reform on the front burner, and I'll look into that because I don't know anything more about it.
The group Redefeat Bush is hosting a rally for the Republic in San Francisco tonight. Tomorrow, Ohio residents are boarding buses to arrive in Washington, D.C. for a Thursday rally in front of the U.S. Capitol. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ingrid Drake from the D.C. Radio Co-op.
Analysis of this year's election in Florida has found that 2/3 of the provisional ballots in that state were rejected. From Tampa, FSRN's Andrew Stelzer reports.
More than 27,000 people filed provisional ballots in Florida. Although final numbers aren't in, only about 1/3 of those were eventually counted. The most troubling statistic, according to Larry Spalding, legal counsel of the Florida ACLU, is that 11% of those ballots were thrown out because the voter was in the wrong precinct.
What Congress didn't do is really address the question that we were dealing with, is if you're in the wrong precinct, what happens? Several states decided to let it count across the board. They didn't have any problem. The Florida legislature, and certainly Florida was not alone in making that decision, said if you weren't in the right precinct, then it didn't count.
Florida was one of 28 states which decided that voters had to be in the correct precinct to cast a provisional ballot, even though one of the problems the provisional ballot was meant to fix was voters coming to the wrong precinct. Reggie Mitchell, the Florida legal director of election protection, says that many people he spoke to were given the wrong information on election day.
I think we need to change the law to allow them to vote in the proper precinct if they've been advised by a poll worker that that's the okay place to vote. We need better training of poll workers, and we need to make provisions where the voter is not injured by some mistake, some administrative error.
Spalding says the ACLU unsuccessfully lobbied the state legislature last year to change the problem, which was made worse by the 4 hurricanes that hit Florida in the summer of 2004.
Certainly as a result of hurricanes and different issues, you had people who, where they voted previously, may not have existed, could have been destroyed in the hurricane, or people were living in different localities because they were required to move.
All 67 of Florida's county election supervisors met in December and are considering creating mega precincts that would solve the problem. Voters would not be required to go to a specific precinct, they would simply have to be in the right county. This would be more similar to how Florida's early voting system works.
Anyone who voted early didn't have the provisional ballot problem because it didn't matter where you were. I suppose the logic was that on election day there were so many people voting that they really didn't have time to do that.
Another 7% of the provisional ballots thrown out were voters who had been purged, either for being on the state's convicted felon list or having not voted in the past 2 federal elections. Thus far, members of both political parties have said they want to make the state's election system work better. Mitchell says the embarrassment of 2000 is not forgotten.
We had what was probably regarded as a smooth election in Florida where we didn't have all of the problems of 2000, but obviously there was voter intimidation. There was all kinds of things going on. So we intend to have public hearings to try and get at the issues, to try and get some of these bills sponsored to promote election reform.
The Florida State Legislature meets in March. Several supervisors of elections have said they will ask state legislators to make election reform a top priority. For FSRN, from WMNF in Tampa, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
In Buenos Aires, hundreds of people are being violently evicted by the state from abandoned factories and houses each week. In the past few years, tenants have formed a popular assembly to resist evictions. One such group, the Tenants' Center of Buenos Aires, or CEBA, using its Spanish acronym, has just won the right to permanently take 18 houses from the state. FSRN correspondent Auro Bogado reports from Buenos Aires.
It's late on a hot and humid night, and over 50 people are gathered in a large house in Buenos Aires City for their weekly Centro de Inquilinos, or Tenants' Center of Buenos Aires, meeting in one of hundreds of seized buildings in Argentina. At 9 p.m., an agenda is set, and for the next 2 to 3 hours, people talk, laugh, and argue. In the end, all agenda items are finally resolved through a voting process, a familiar decision-making method for various popular assemblies throughout Buenos Aires. The Tenant Center was started over 20 years ago, organizing renters throughout the province, originally through conventional and legal means. More recently, people here have had to literally take abandoned homes and apartments because they simply have nowhere else left to go. Pedro is one of the members of this assembly. Eyeing a very large home across the street, which he knows is owned by the state, he explains the process by which houses are taken.
Before we open a house, we look at different things. First, we see if the house belongs to the municipality, because if there are no private owners, if there aren't, then we're all owners. The state is the owner. And so, if it's municipal property, the eviction process is much slower. We tell them it's not private property, instead it's state property, and since there's people, there's human beings that are living in the street, the state has to turn over the houses one way or another so that people no longer have to live on the street.
The majority of those people that live on the street are victims of the country's economic collapse 3 years ago. Before then, during the monetary boom, many immigrants from neighboring countries came to share in Argentina's short-lived wealth. Julia arrived from Peru 5 years ago. She found work and a place to live immediately. After losing her job, she took residence in an abandoned candy factory along with several other immigrant families. Last August, all 60 families were brutally evicted.
They came, it was all police. They came and we had our kids there in the middle of the night who were asleep, and without any remorse, they came and took the house. And they took a lot of families with a lot of violence. They took them from their beds. They took them like this, beating them. Well, now we're all on the street.
Julia, along with nearly all the rest of the families that were evicted, joined the Tenant Center Assembly after the violent episode. The group organizes collective meetings, finds houses to take from the state, coordinates demonstrations, and through a complicated but very efficient phone tree, stops middle-of-the-night evictions from the taken homes. Last week, they won 18 huge dwellings from the state to call their own. This type of victory, which will house approximately 50 families, is the first for the group. Since so many people consider themselves part of the assembly, the method by which residents are picked to live in the houses won from the state is decided by which members attend the most meetings, protests, and direct actions. Roll call is taken at every meeting. Roberto Francisco Núñez González, whose neighbors work three jobs to feed their family, attends every meeting and protest in his neighbor's place in the spirit of solidarity.
Since others don't have any time to attend, I took charge of going to the protests in their place. I made myself present. I grabbed sticks. I covered my face. I carried our banners, our flag, and everything representing that family. I will be there, whatever it is, to represent them.
In just a few weeks, Nunez's neighbors will be one of the families who will finally have a house to permanently call their own. Reporting from Buenos Aires, Argentina, I'm Aura Bogado for Free Speech Radio News.
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations WBAI in New York, KPFA in Berkeley, and KPFK in Los Angeles, and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Monica Lopez and Simba Russo. Headlines editors are Randy Zimmerman and Nell Abram. Our DC editor is Mitch Jeserich. Our technical production team is Jade Paget-Seekins, Pauline Bartolone, Mick Milan, and Eric Klein. Special thanks to Transbay for web services. Free Speech Radio News is a worker-run collective. For more information, you can visit our website at www.fsrn.org. In New York, I'm Deepa Fernandez.